Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Walter Mosley, whose latest novel is Little Green. Walter Mosley is the author of several books. This is the 12th Easy Rawlins mystery. There are also four Leonid McGill mysteries. There's also a Fearless Jones series, stories about Socrates Fortlow, several novels. Many are science fiction, as it turns out. A number of them are science fiction. He's a playwright and a screenwriter as well, and we'll talk a lot about that. But we're going to start by talking about The Return of Easy Rawlins. Easy is your best-known character, and in the previous novel, Blonde Faith, at the end, he goes off a cliff, and my assumption, at least, was that he was dead.
Mm.
That may have been the assumption of a number of people, but he's not, and he's brought back. So I guess the place to start is, why did you bring him back? I know that you've said that you didn't want to be defined by Easy Rawlins, and you've written about 15 books since.
Yeah. I stopped writing, not so much because I didn't want to be defined by him, though that is true, but because I felt like the next book would have been stale. It would have been just another Easy Rawlins novel. You know, I was talking to somebody the other day. I said, you know, the first 20 May Gray novels by Simenon were great, but the next 60 weren't, you know, they were kind of like redundant. And I didn't want to be there. And Easy was dead the way fictional characters are dead. I mean, I wasn't writing him anymore. Easy can't really die because he's fictional, but he might cease to be. But about a year or two ago, I started thinking about, what would I do about, you know, writing Easy? And then the idea for this book, the thing that struck me about what I do with fiction, most of my characters and most of the stories I write are about redemption. Characters trying to redeem either themselves or maybe somebody else who they're representing, trying to help out. This is the first and probably only book I'll write about resurrection. It goes way beyond redemption. This is a man who, in his own heart, has been dead, and the whole book is him coming back to life.
As you conceive that, that's suddenly when you realize you could write another Easy Rawlins.
Yeah, well, then it was wonderful. Then I could write a completely different book. And it's still Easy Rawlins. He's still the same guy. He still lives the same life. Reading the first two chapters, that's very clear. But in coming back to life, he finds himself in a new world. It's only 2 months later, but the world for him is absolutely new. And he, in many ways, is new.
So, in a sense, by bringing him back the way you bring him back, you bring back the old character, but at the same time, you bring back a new character.
Yeah, exactly. And so then I feel wonderful about writing. I just finished, actually, writing the next Easy Rawlins, and I'm really excited about where I'm going with it.
It always struck me that what set Easy apart was the fact that we got to see a cross-section of history and the way African Americans are treated in Los Angeles, which kind of stands in for the United States. So we're seeing a historical progression through the eyes of a single character, which we don't normally get to see.
Yeah, and you see it in ways that are not predictable. There's a lot of what's accepted of how we look at characters. I wrote a novel recently where a black woman is leaving a white woman's house at 5 o'clock in the morning, and she's going back and forth because she has her makeup and she's doing stuff in the house and doing stuff outside, and the police come and arrest her and put her in handcuffs. And I was talking, you know, to a person who's trying to get me to change the book, a white person trying to get me to change the book, and that white person is trying to tell me that the police don't put black women in handcuffs. And it was an interesting thing. Whether he was right or I was right, doesn't really matter. What matters is that the world that I'm depicting is a world easily imagined about black people, about themselves, and not so easily imagined about white people, about their prejudice, about what black people, what their experience is. You know, so, you know, the fact that Jackson Blue is the senior vice president of the largest insurance company in the world, that Mouse is one of the most successful heist men in the United States, maybe North America, all of that are kind of things that you wouldn't expect that. And you wouldn't expect this in any kind of redemptive sense. You wouldn't expect, well, what are you trying to say about, you know, black people? Are you trying to make them as good as white people? And I said, I don't need to do that. You know, I just need to make them human. If black people are human and living human lives and they're successful and they're unsuccessful, they live good and bad lives, that's all I need to do. But that's not normal. And really, I have to add, there's hardly anybody in America now or at any other time writing about black male heroes. many people write about black male protagonists, but when you talk about a hero, that's very unusual.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that America is very afraid of black men and red men. Both of those people are people who there's a great deal of guilt inside the culture, inside the knowledge of the history of the culture. And so to have an Indian, Native American, Aboriginal American, whatever you want to call him, as a hero, to have a black man as a hero, that's like, people don't want that, you know.
Do we see that reflected in views toward Obama, you think?
I think that Obama has had to fit inside of expectations in order to be president. I don't hold that against him because everybody who becomes president has to do that. But I don't think that he could be like a black male hero in the way that Mouse is or Easy is or Socrates Fortlow is. So like the everyday guy, you know, on the street, they're going to love Obama, of course, because he's the first black man to be president. But they're going to identify with Socrates.
Looking at Obama through that lens, you can see that fear from white people would hold him back on doing maybe what he could be doing, assuming that Obama would want to.
Him being president makes them stupid. I mean, like, makes a lot of people stupid. I was on a panel the other day, and a guy said, well, you know, Americans aren't going to have free thought anymore because, you know, Obama's a socialist, and he's made America into a socialist nation. So, and it's like, I laughed so hard. And then I said, wow, I'm laughing instead of being mad. How interesting. You know, because, you know, it's just the idea, you know, one, that Obama's a socialist. I mean, that's ridiculous. But let's even say it was true, you know, like FDR was kind of a socialist. But the idea of saying that he made us into a socialist nation, that somehow in a few years America became a socialist nation, it's like, wow, he's so frightening to some people that they've lost their cognitive abilities.
Walter Mosley, let's get back to Little Green. It takes place in 1967 in Los Angeles. You have this great interview that I'm keep referring to that's on your website, linked on your website, in which you talk about various issues, and one of which is what changes for you in writing this book is your own memories as a teenager suddenly come into play.
Yeah. When I was a kid, I lived down near Fairfax and Pico. So actually, you know, if you were a walker, which I was, you could actually walk to the Sunset Strip, which I did often enough. And, you know, sometimes I took my bicycle, sometimes somebody drove. But that was so amazing. In 66, 67, 68, on the Sunset Strip, at night, there were 10,000 unwashed, long-haired, barefoot hippies walking up and down the street. It was amazing. If you went into the Whiskey-A-Go-Go, they put like a tab of acid on your tongue as you walked in the front door, you know. And I think in 67 it was still legal. Whenever it was still legal, that's when they did that. And it was just an amazing, it was like a new world. I was talking to somebody before saying, you know, one day you look at a guy and he has short hair and he's ready to go off to the Marines. And next day he has hair down to his butt and he's hitchhiking up to the Bay Area to live in a commune. You know, it was just amazing the how the world had changed and how close I think music had brought white culture to black culture. But all of the new things, because white culture had naturally optimistic, saying we're going to change the world. Black people never saying that, saying, man, we're just going to try to get free, we're just going to try to get you off our ass. But white culture saying we're going to revolutionize the whole country. It's a notion. So this dialogue, people who are somewhat simple because they're ostracized and prejudiced against, but at the same time, different in the way they understood the world.
I noticed that Easy, for instance, begins to realize as the book goes on that the long-haired hippies are going to be as oppressed in some respects as black people, so suddenly they're on an equal footing with him.
Well, they're going to understand his experience more, you know. It's just that I remember the thing when I was living in Santa Cruz for a while, and I wanted to get a job at a cannery, and they wouldn't hire me or any of my white friends because we had long hair. And I remember talking to him, I said, but man, 50% of people work here are women, and they all have long hair. And he said, but they can wear hairnets. I said, I could wear a hairnet, you know, and they said, no, you can't work here. You know, it was a really interesting thing. So me and this white guy standing next to me were being held out, you know, kind of for the same reason. They might not have hired me anyway, you know, for being black. That wouldn't have surprised me. But they won't hire this guy because of his hair. And you need to be something different in order to be here.
There's another element which plays a role, is that in the earlier E.Z. Rollins stories, when a cop shows up in a neighborhood, everybody gets scared and runs away. But in this one, there's a confrontation, and the cop gets scared and runs away, and that's completely new.
And it's a new world, you know. It's a world where, you know, you can't say all black people are the same or all white people are the same. People are different. He's just walking down the street. He's you know, still in the early part of his resurrection. He's very weak. The police arrest him for public drunkenness, or try to arrest him for public drunkenness. And a black guy comes out of a mechanic shop and says, man, leave him alone. He's not doing anything. He's just walking down the street. He's not driving a car. And they turn to him and say, you know, be quiet. N-word. But then the white people who work with the black guy in the mechanic shop come out and say, what did you call him? And then they start talking to each other. You know, Joe might be right. You know, all that stuff he's always saying. It might be true that people actually say these things to him. You know, and then there's a confrontation between the white people, the police, and the property owner. Who the police, they can't jump on the property owner. They have to, you know, they're there to protect his property.
Walter Mosley, what kind of research did you do aside from your own memories on L.A. in 1967?
You know, as a fiction writer, I don't do research. It's very interesting. I know that's like a bad thing to admit, you know. It's like admitting you read comic books or that you masturbate or something, you know. But the truth is, I don't do research. I write the whole book, and then I go back and I read it very carefully, saying, I wonder if that's true. I wonder if that's true. And then I go and I check on those things that I wonder about. But other than that, I don't. You know, I experienced it. You know, and novels, you know, at one point novels were, you know, were television and radio and all those other things. They gave you all your information about the world so you could have a book like Moby Dick. Well, I have to explain to you all the ways that a whale ship works. You don't do that anymore. Novels are mostly psychological. And so I'm pretty confident about the psyche. And also it's very interesting. It's very hard to do research on the psyche. You know, so what were people like in 1940? You go, I really don't know.
That's when you have to fall back on 1967 for yourself, I guess. So yeah. It's easier to write the younger generation than to write E.Z. at that point, I would think, even though you know E.Z. really well.
Yeah, no, it's not. I know E.Z. very well, and, you know, you usually know the older generation better than your own because you're a child with them. But, you know, I wrote a book about a plantation in Georgia in 1840, and, you know, yeah, I was just winging that, but I did.
How do you compare writing E.Z. to, say, writing Leonid McGill? Leonid is also a detective.
Well, the difference, there are two differences. You know, one, E.Z. Rollins and Leonid McGill are two very different characters. They're from different, you know, Leonid is from New York, E.Z. is from the Deep South. They're both orphans, but Leonid's father was an anarchist who thought he was a communist, who taught Leonid about being a communist, but then left him, so Leonid became a criminal. And E.Z. did not become a criminal. E.Z. lived a very, you know, good life. But the big difference between them is the period of time in which they live. I often say that if I saw a young black man in Detroit in the 20th century, I said, how you doing, brother? He said, you know, it's hard on a black man in Detroit. And I said, I agree. In the 21st century, I see the young black man say, how's it going, brother? He said, well, you know, it's tough on a black man in Detroit. I said, you know, you're right, man, but there's a guy in Kandahar who'd be more than happy to do an apartment swap with us. It's a bigger world. Race necessarily becomes a smaller issue because the world is so large. So E.Z. can't get away from racism. Leonid hardly has time to pay attention to it.
You said in that interview I mentioned before that Leonid is more about class.
Yes.
Whereas E.Z.'s more about race.
Yeah. Yeah. He's dealing more with the naked power structure, rather than that power structure being interpreted through race, you know, because black men and women were the first modern proletariat, you know. We were owned, we were property by definition, and we worked for the system of capitalism. And so race and capitalism kind of became the same thing. In Leonid's world, they've separated out again.
You're listening to an interview with Walter Mosley, whose latest novel is Little Green. Another interesting quote is, you said in that interview that the more integration you have, the more conflict you have, which would tend to mean that on some level it would be easier to create a plot, say, for Leonid than it would for E.Z.
When E.Z. is talking about it, like, you know, in the 60s, 64, 65, 66, 67, he had much more leeway. He could go to many more different places than he could, let's say, in the 50s, in the very early 60s. But because integration had grown and he could go different places, he got in trouble more often. Because when he went to those places, people still didn't think he belonged there, but they couldn't stop him from being there. So he would run into conflict with security guards, police, people, you know, who guard front doors, secretaries. Everybody is saying, yes, what are you doing here? And he says, well, I belong here. He says, well, prove it, you know. So that's more conflict. By the time you get to the 21st century and Leonid McGill, that's not so much an issue. The conflict is, you know, what kind of shoes are you wearing? What kind of clothes are you wearing? How much money do you represent? What kind of education do you have? That kind of stuff.
Do you think that a lot of what you're talking about reflects in your own development and how you look at the world, that it was more defined by race at one time and now is more defined by class? Or is this just a matter of writing history?
You know, it's very hard for me to tell how to answer that question. One of the things that I always say when giving my political talks is that the older you are, the more you live in the past. And that the youngest people know this world the best. So my understanding of my experience of race and a 20-year-old young man's experience of race might be vastly different in this exact same arena. And that has to do with the way we know the world. There are a few caveats about the older you are, the more you live in the past. One is how dangerous your life is, how pressured you are. If you're pressured to survive, you know, like you're thrown on an island filled with poisonous plants and deadly animals, you can be living right in the present. Right here, right. Because you have to face this problem, you have to understand this problem, you have to solve it. Leonid, therefore, lives in the modern world, in the present, because he's always in trouble. His kids are always in trouble, you know, and the police are always after him. They say, we are going to bust you. You did something wrong. And he did do many things wrong. And so he lives in the present. But, you know, my life isn't nearly so precious.
Walter Mosley, I keep thinking that when you talk about racism and how things have changed a little bit, some ways they haven't. I mean, we still have the stories of people like Oscar Grant. I mean, this is still going on.
No, absolutely. Well, listen, we have the prison system. Yeah. People of color, Native Americans, so-called Hispanic Americans, African Americans. I mean, we fill out the beds in the prisons. You know, we fill out the unemployment rolls. We fill out all of that stuff. You know, and to me, you know, I've been thinking for so long. You haven't asked me this, but I've been thinking so long. What's the answer? And I finally came up with the answer. You know, that in Europe, there weren't white people. There were people who had different cultural backgrounds. In Great Britain, the place that's Great Britain now alone, you had six different races and people who identified them as different races. And like, you know, if you called a Swede a Greek, he'd kill you. If you called a Greek, a Viking, he'd kill you. And then they came here. They had to get rid of the red man in order to take his land, and they had to make the black people into slaves. So they found themselves in between these two groups of people, and the white man was born. You know, when you look at people, there are no white people, and there's all kinds of different racial things they have, the color of their eyes, color of their hair, how their nose and their lips and their ears, all these different things are different. And it turns to me and says, well, there's really no such thing as a white man. And so, or woman. And so the answer is, as soon as they stop saying they're white people, as soon as they stop identifying with this thing that was made up simply to oppress people, racism will be over. I'd be really happy. It's the white people, and there are no such things as white people. Like, just like there's no such thing as black people.
When you take somebody whose ancestors are, say, you know, American Indian, Swedish, black, mm-hmm. African, and I don't know, Chinese, mm-hmm. what is that person?
Yeah, right. Well, and today they say, well, that's a black man, a black woman. But in truth, there are all these different races and cultures. But you see, black people can say we aren't black people. It doesn't matter. Nobody listens. Nobody cares because that's what we are.
It's got to come from the dominant group.
Well, the dominant group has to stop identifying themselves as being white people. And once they do, then everything is fine.
So people who identify themselves as Jewish rather than white have taken the next step in some respects.
No, I mean, Jews have never been white. I mean, it is the notion that a Jew is a white man, you know, I mean, like, that's just somebody who doesn't know their European history, you know, or their Egyptian history, or their, like, Middle Eastern. I mean, there was no point where, you know, me knowing this, being a Jew, my mother being Jewish, there's no point where we were identified with the dominant culture. We identify ourselves, you know, there's all that assimilation stuff going on, but no. Jews have always been a separate race. You know, gypsies have always been a separate race. It's like the notion that one belongs to the dominant culture, you know, it's like, you know, that's that Malcolm X thing. Is we sick, boss? You know, it's like, no, the boss is sick. You are not sick.
Walter Mosley, I'd like to ask you one more question about Little Green. Is there a difference in constructing the basic mystery story separated out between a book like Little Green and, say, a book like Known to Evil? I mean, they're two different detectives. They're working in two different environments. But is constructing the story of, say, Leonid McGill and an E.Z. Rollins, is that similar or on some deeper level different?
It's a good question when you talk about the genre, the so-called mystery detective crime genre. I think the thing that separates it out from other forms of writing is the fact that the plot is so important and so intricate. So, you know, in a literary novel, you know, there might only be one question, you know, in the end, you know, will they be in love or won't they be in love? Will they be together? Won't they be together? Will this guy finally understand that his world doesn't make sense and be destroyed by it? Or will he forever live in the dream that his life is perfect? You know, that's a simple question. And it goes through kind of psychological relationships, which in some ways makes literary novels very difficult to write. But in a mystery, that something has happened. We're not quite sure what it is that's happened. We know that somebody's dead. We know that somebody has killed this person. But we don't know how we got there. And then what that novel does is traces its way backwards into that. Because of that, you have to address the plot at least on every other page. Whereas in a literary novel, you could address it every other chapter. So that's the difference. And so that's what the two books have in common. Then what you said makes the differences. Who are the characters? What period of time do the characters live in? How do they respond to things? How smart are they? How savvy are they? How cowardly are they? All of those things, you know, make up the differences in qualities of the character and how that character's story unfolds.
You've written a lot of mainstream books as well, a lot of literary novels. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's easier to put subtext in a mystery or in a literary novel?
It depends. No, it's not easier, but the subtext may be different. You know, you may be dealing more with moral issues in a book like Little Green, whereas you're dealing with a universal concept when you do, you know, Ptolemy Gray and dementia. It's what fits. When I wrote the book Blue Light, which, you know, is my first speculative novel, it was a book where I think I am not in any way spiritual or religious or in any way. Except I believe in the soul. I can't help it. I believe I have one. But I don't know why. I can't prove it. And so I wrote that book to try to explain how I feel. Not to say it's true or not true, just how I feel. It would be silly to try to write a crime novel to do that, or to write a literary novel even to do that. So science fiction works for that.
Do you think it's easier or harder to write a science fiction short story or novel? Because the novel, you're creating an entire world. Whereas mm-hmm. in a short story, you're staying focused.
Well, you know, this is interesting. I'm going to disagree with you there. In a novel and a short story, you create an entire world. In a novel, the entire world is like a mountain that you can see from afar. And as you get close, you get more of the details, but you lose the greater form. A short story is like an island in the middle of the ocean beneath which there is a mountain that you can't see. And the detritus of that mountain gets washed up on the shore. And you have to be able to understand through reading the short story what that mountain is like beneath the island, which is much more difficult.
So in that sense, before you as the writer walk in, you have to know the mountain in both cases.
Exactly. But you don't get to explain it in a short story. You do in the novel. E.M. Forster says, a novel is 50,000 words, more or less, of spongy prose. The prose in the short story is crystalline.
It has to be worked over word by word, like a poem.
Yes.
Walter Mosley, you've done a lot of work in media as well. Where do we sit now on things like The Last Days of Ptolemy Gray? It was optioned to Samuel L. Jackson.
And he's, Gabriel Garcia Marquez's son is directing it, and we have a writer for it now. And HBO is completely committed to doing it. So I suspect within the next, 9 months to a year, that movie will appear on HBO.
And series about Fearless Jones or Easy, those are dead right now?
Fearless Jones is not breathing, but the Easy stuff people are still trying to do, we'll see. We've been talking to Amazon about maybe doing a series with them. We'll see what they say. And, then I'm trying to do the Socrates series with Lawrence Fishburne. I'm trying to do Debbie Doesn't Do It Anymore, my next novel with HBO.
In that interview, I keep going back to it, you make this amazing comment, which I'd never thought about, which is when you were talking about the Always Outnumbered movie that got made,
mm-hmm.
that was HBO, and you said that making a movie is the people see a hook, and then they try to make your book fit into the hook, whereas HBO said, just tell your story.
Yeah, no, they were very good about that. HBO is very good. It's hard for them because everybody wants to do stuff with them, so it's hard to get stuff made there. But when they finally make the commitment to it, they have a human quality that I haven't found with most other organizations, networks, etc.
Well, you did something for Showtime that I'd never heard of, an episode of something called Fallen Angels, where Bill Nunn played Fearless and the amazing Giancarlo Esposito played Paris Minton. When did that come out?
96, 97.
A long time ago.
Yeah.
Are there any other projects in the works that you have going?
Well, I wrote a short story, a letter from a dead man that came out in Atlantic. Robert Downey Jr.'s company found it very interesting, and they want to do a series. So they've gotten together with the writers from Friday Night Lights and myself, and we're pushing forward, trying to make a series out of that. Certainly, I want to do a series with Leona McGill. I'm going to call it The Long Fall from the first book, thinking about doing that. I think that's it. I think that's everything right now.
If these came to fruition, would you want to be showrunner or would you just sit on the side?
No, I'd be showrunner. I was talking to a showrunner one day. He said, the first thing he said was, I make $1 million a year. And I thought, that's a nice income. But then he explained to me how hard he worked. He worked 80, 90-hour weeks in a situation which people were always trying to stab him in the back and any mistake could get him fired. And I was thinking, number one, he worked so many hours that, the $1 million, a year, kind of the hourly wages, And the other thing was just, all of the pressure and doing something that in the end, nobody's going to know you did and you probably won't be proud of because it's television and it gets massaged so much before it comes out. So I thought, wow, no, I would never be a showrunner. What I said to the guys, with the Downey company, I wouldn't be in the writer's room. I'd be, like a writer. I'd be a junior writer, but, maybe just a normal everyday writer, just to see how it works, how it comes together. Because it's fun. The process is fun. It's just that when you come to the end, you're not going to get something satisfying like a novel or a play. It's not going to happen.
Well, people like Pelicanos and Lehane worked on The Wire and were perfectly happy in the writer's room.
Yeah, and the writer's room is fine, I mean, it's fine if you want to do it, And I would like to see what it's like. And I like, collaborative work. But on the other hand, you can never beat writing novels.
Speaking of collaborative work, you recently had a play in Chicago called Fall of Heaven.
Right.
How did that go?
Oh, that was so much fun. It was the third time I've done that play. It's based on my book, The Tempest Tales. It's a really tiny, tiny little black company. There's a lot of serious questions. A guy gets shut down by the police. He goes up to heaven. St. Peter says, you're going to go to hell. He refuses. And it turns out that because of free will, they don't have to do what Peter says. So he sends it back to Earth in another body with an angel. And so there's a lot of very serious topics discussed, but it's a very funny play. And this company really got it. And it was like when you sat there and watched it, number one, it's a, 90-minute play. It feels like it's about 30 minutes long, which is great. And you just kind of laugh all the way through it, And I wrote it and stuff like that, but, the actors, take it up and put life to it. I was laughing at how the actors interpreted the words that I had written. I wasn't laughing at my own words. I was laughing at a reinterpretation of it. And it was wonderful. I had a great time.
You've seen other people say your words before, I mean, because of the movies that you've done.
And that's true, too. You know, I mean, Devil in Blue Dress, a wonderful film, Always Outnumbered, also wonderful. I've had great experiences in Hollywood. It's because I don't have any expectation of making lots of money. You know, I just want to make, you know, good work, which is not what most people think about Hollywood, which is one of the problems with movies now, you know. I mean, television is actually more interested than interesting than films. Because, you know, I mean, I have a gigantic comic book collection. I love comic books. But I went to a theater in L.A., a big complex, and there were 12 movies playing, and six of them were comic book titles. And I went, this is too much. I just need one comic book title. I'd like to see, you know, a couple of, you know, Drugstore Cowboy and, you know, The Godfather. I would like to see some good film, too, you know.
Walter Mosley, what are you working on now, and how many books do you work on at once?
I only work on one at a time. You know, what happens is you finish a book, you turn it to the editor, and I write every day, so then I start a new book. And then I keep writing on that book, and the editor sends me that book back. I work on that one, and then I send it back. I finish the one I'm working on, I send it in, and then I'm working on the third one, and they come back. You know, so like it's like I'm juggling, but at any one period of time, I'm only working on one book. I've just finished the next Easy Rollins novel, Rose Gold. I'm probably going to do some edits on Debbie Doesn't Do It Anymore. I've turned in another book to Tor, the science fiction publisher, called In a Silver Box, and I have some editing to do on that. So that's what I'm working on.
How about any nonfiction these days?
Well, you know, I have an interpretation of the 20th century. Any century can be defined by conflicts. One of the major conflicts of the 20th century is socialism versus capitalism. And that makes sense. They needed to hate each other because they were so different and they wanted to control the world in such different ways. But in the 21st century, you know, I think that we might be sophisticated enough to understand that certain parts of our culture have to be capitalistic and certain parts of our culture have to be socialistic. And so I want to write a book, and I have the title. It's called Moving the Red into the Black, and to understand how we can interpret ourselves as having both sides exist in our lives. That's a piece of nonfiction that I want to write. I haven't figured out how to write it yet, though.
And then, of course, there's the next stage. Once you figure it out and put it out, how can it come to fruition? I mean, how can the ideas become real?
That's great. The great thing about being a writer is I don't have to worry about that. One of the problems I think that Marx, which was a great diagnostician, his mistake was trying to become a politician. Where when he started to define revolution, like how the government would look and stuff like that, he fell apart. When he diagnosed how capitalism informs and restructures our lives, he was a genius.
One final question about Easy Rollins. He's in his 50s, I believe.
47.
He's 47 mm-hmm. in Little Green. So he started out
28.
At 28?
Yeah.
And how long is he going to last? Do you have any idea?
I don't know. I just saw a billboard outside saying we have to plan to live to 105. So he can get kind of old.
He could be around today.
He could.
You've been listening to an interview with Walter Mosley, whose latest novel is Little Green, an Easy Rollins Mystery. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.